So I guess I'm the last speaker before we open the floor to question and answers. So I wanted to thank Alan for his story, and I sort of want to start off my talk by pointing out that Alan's story is not an individualized case, and we shouldn't take it as such, because there are millions, and I carefully don't say thousands, but I say millions of examples of people like Alan who are treated as economic commodities within Canada's immigration system, who are apparently good enough to work here but are not good enough to stay, who are good enough to pay taxes but are not good enough to be able to benefit from things like healthcare even though they pay taxes for it, for people who are good enough to emigrate here when they can provide us a service but are not good enough to be able to be granted status. So I work with a group called No One Is Illegal, and we are a grassroots activist organization, and we mobilize around immigrant and refugee rights. And I think Professor McLaughlin she outlined the racialization of our immigration system and how that can work against people of color from working class communities, primarily from the global south. And Alan has sort of touched upon the seasonal workers agricultural program and the repercussions that can have on people of color from working class communities, from the Caribbean, from the Philippines, from Mexico. I sort of want to talk about a couple of other cases to broaden the analysis and discuss how No One Is Illegal has worked to mobilize around immigrant and refugee rights, and particularly around the rights of non-status undocumented people. Like I said, Alan's case is not isolated. There are over 500,000 people across Ontario who do not have status. Over 80,000 of those people live in Ontario alone, right? So the numbers are high, and it's not a small issue, but I'm afraid to say it's a very under-discussed issue, and it's not an issue that has been given the attention that it deserves within activism, within academia, definitely not within the political sphere. I want to sort of talk about the production of illegality, and as No One Is Illegal, we don't like to use the term illegal immigrants because we challenge the notion of what it means to be illegal in the first place. So we have within the rhetoric we use, within the systematic language that we use to describe people who are non-status, we constantly call those who are trying to flee situations of war, occupation, or poverty illegal immigrants. We call immigrants who have fled from, if you look at the largest refugee populations today, for example, they all come from war-torn countries, right? You look at Afghanistan, you look at Iraq, you look at Haiti, you look at Palestine, surprise, surprise, all nations in which there's a current occupation by Western forces, and these are our largest refugee populations. You look at what NAFTA has done to places like Mexico and the sheer volume of refugees it has displaced, the sheer number of indigenous populations that have been forced to migrate to look for better economic opportunities, to find jobs because of policies implemented by the West within the global south or within places like Mexico that force people to have to migrate. And then when migrants come here, they are treated like second-class citizens. And a part of our analysis sort of elaborates on that, because I think that it is in the interest of the Canadian government to keep people non-status, because that allows the government to have an accessible, cheap, exploitable pool of labor. Non-status undocumented workers are those who will work, they work the longest hours for the least amount of pay. They cannot join unions. Professor McLaughlin talked about the live-in caregiver program, right? People who come under that program, they have to live within their employer's home. If they are fired, they have to find a new job within 3 months. And if they, I think it's 3 months or is it 6 months? It's three, it used to be six. I think it's 3 months now. And if they, during that 3 months, they, when you come as part of a live-in care, as part of the live-in caregiver program, you are barred from working in any occupation but within the live-in caregiver services, and that too under your employer's home, the one who sponsored you, right? So your visa is basically in the hands of your employer. So what happens when there's a conflict of interest and you're fired, if you don't find a job within 3 months, you're deported. And within that 3 months, you're considered non-status, right? So there are situations of such women who come to Canada, who have been working in their employer's home, who have been raped, who have been abused, who have been fired and discharged for completely unfair or arbitrary reasons. And when they try to survive by finding another job while looking for another live-in caregiving job, they're often put in detention or they are often deported, right? Because they're considered non-status. So as part of No One Is Illegal's analysis, we don't consider all migrants who are non-status illegal. We definitely don't consider people who are fleeing occupation, war, or poverty to be illegal. And I think we have to sort of think about the type of, the way in which we sort of use these type of terms. I also wanted to touch upon the fact that known as illegals work, mobilizing around immigrant and refugee rights, has to be situated in a broader analysis around global capitalism, around patriarchy, and around imperialism. Migration is an extremely gendered concept. The vast majority of those who are part of the most impoverished communities within the migrant communities are those who are women, right? We have to talk about global capitalism. We have to talk about the Western nations or the West's role in basically forcing migration, right? So Canada is currently, for example, part of an occupation in Haiti. Yet when Haitian refugees come here, we see in the newspapers Haitians trying to leech off Canada's welfare system. Large influx of Haitian refugees taking over the Windsor border. We've all read these statements, right? You look at Iraq, you look at Palestine. The West has intervened within these nations, but when we force migrants to have to migrate, basically indigenous populations don't wake up one day and say, I want to leave everything I know behind. I want to leave my family behind because Canada has an awesome welfare system, right? There are reasons why people are forced to migrate, and Canada is often complicit within that reasoning. And also, I think it's a wide misconception to say that immigrants or refugees often come here because we have such great resources or because they can leech up our welfare system. Because statistically, it is shown that Canadian citizens use welfare more than immigrants, right? That is a stat, and it's a wide misconception. Not to mention the fact that if you do not have status, you cannot access welfare. If you don't have status, you cannot access subsidized housing, you cannot access healthcare, you cannot access police services, right? So we have come to sort of buy into this Canadian mythology, fed on by politicians, fed on by the media, scapegoating immigrant communities and blaming them for our economic problems, when statistically, if you actually just look at the facts, non-status people don't have access to these resources, which we are constantly accusing them of sort of trying to leech off, right? I wanted to talk about Canadian immigration machinery, basically the type of immigrants that Canada is looking for. So I think Professor McLaughlin touched upon it really well. I just wanted to elaborate by sort of adding that there are basically two types of immigrants that Canada currently actively seeks out, right? So the first type are the type who have capital, who are not working class communities, but people who are from privileged communities, who have capital to invest within the Canadian economy, who have education, who speak two languages. But at the same time, the Toronto Star reported just 6 months ago that the majority of immigrants and even citizens today would not qualify under Canada's current point system, right? So we have to sort of think about why we've made the rules so stringent, and we also have to understand that that's all a part of the larger analysis of producing immigrants as illegal. So we hear all this rhetoric about illegal immigrants, but is it that more and more immigrants have become illegal, or more immigrants are breaking the law? Or is it that our system has become increasingly stringent, and so stringent now that more and more people can be classified as illegal under that type of a system? I wanted to give you an example. There was a live-in caregiver. There was a person who came as part of the live-in caregiver program just recently, and her visa stipulates that she had to work as a live-in caregiver for 2 years before she could apply for status. 2 months before her two-year term ended, she got cancer, and she was deported and detained, and she was not able to sponsor her family. And what she asked of the Canadian state was that because she was only 2 months away from her term, that she continue to be allowed to work because the cancer wouldn't be affecting her for another 6 months or so, and she wanted to sponsor her family, her two children and her husband, have them come to Canada to potentially leave a better life before she passed on. And Canada said no, that she was a burden to our healthcare system, and so she was deported, and there were thousands of cases like it. There's the case of Laibar Singh, known as illegal, currently did a couple of months ago a demonstration for him. Laibar Singh, he was paralyzed and he was put in the hospital, and immigration enforcement came into the hospital, took him off his hospital bed because he was non-status, and sent him to a detention center. And because he was paralyzed, it was said that he was also a burden on our healthcare system, and his refugee claim was currently being processed, but it was denied on the grounds that A, he was in the hospital taking up resources, and B, because he was paralyzed, and he was subsequently deported as well. In May 2008, there was a factory raid in Mississauga. So there's an SDR factory, and basically there was a completely, and this is following tactics of US-style immigration enforcement, so more and more we're seeing an attack on immigrant communities within the public's realm, right? So last year in Toronto, I'm from Toronto, so there's a mall called Dufferin Mall. What happened in the mall, after this is after the Conservatives came into power, every single exit in the mall was barred off by an immigration officer, and every person of Caribbean or Latin American descent was carded for ID to show status. But every person who was white was allowed to exit the mall, right? This is blatant, explicit racial profiling. It is illegal under our constitution. It is illegal under our charter. And most importantly, just looking at it from ground up, who carries their status around, right? Who carries their immigration documents around, right? This was an attack on immigrant communities within that area, and it was an attack on a very particular body of color. During that time, we've also seen people get carded for status and ID in grocery stores, in their offices and workplaces, in doctors' offices, in subway stations, on the streets, and no one is illegal. Very quickly mobilized around these issues and sort of put up these very spontaneous demonstrations in the doctor's offices, around the grocery stores, in the workplaces, in the daycare centers where these things were happening, in front of hospitals. And, you know, I'm glad to say that so far that has stopped, but there's nothing to say that it won't come back because the Conservatives are in power again, and increasingly we are upping our immigration system to reflect that of the U.S., and U.S. is known for doing these type of spontaneous raids. And I think it's also really important to acknowledge that I think more than just the demonstrations around mobilizing around these issues, more than the protests, more than the rallies that we put together, what really helped was immigrant resistance, right? So migrant communities knowing their rights, immigrants were arrested because they refused to show ID, and they quoted the Constitution, they quoted the Charter, and they said, I don't have to show you my ID, but they were arrested, but subsequently they were let go, and it was a big deal in the media. Immigration enforcement did not look so good within the media that day, and I think that's a big part of why we've been able to shame them into stopping. But like I said, there's nothing to say that it's not going to happen again, especially under Canada's new legislation, Bill C-50. How many of you have heard of Bill C-50? So Bill C-50 basically stipulates that under Canada's Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, more and more immigrants will be allowed to come on temporary work visas, which basically goes back to our history of treating bodies of color and immigrants as economic commodities. More and more immigrants will be able to come here on temporary work visas, meaning they come here, they contribute their labor on a very specified contract, and when they have finished contributing their labor, they are barred from, you know, applying for status, and they're forced to leave, right? And also, under Bill C-50, it allows the immigration minister to fast-track quite arbitrarily what applicants it wants to process first, and it also allows the immigration minister to discard applicants. So prior to Bill C-50, so basically last year, every single immigrant or refugee applicant had to have their application looked at. Now, with the new legislation, which has been passed, even though it wasn't even voted on in the House of Commons, there's a very undemocratic process into the way in which it was passed, but now the immigration minister no longer needs to look at every single refugee applicant. They don't care if you come from a war, or fleeing a war or an occupation or looking for a better life. They have every right to fast track the type of labor they need, and they're going to look for labor that fit our sort of labor shortages within the Canadian economy. So if you look at garments, construction, manufacturing, live-in caregiving services, food services, these are the spaces in which we need to get the most number of immigrants coming because we are facing a shortage. And those are the applicants that are going to be processed the quickest. So in terms of Canada's rhetoric about us needing to, you know, sort of get the best and the brightest of immigrants, the smartest. We want the ones that speak two languages and are the ones who are the most educated. But then they come here, we don't recognize their jobs, we don't recognize their degrees, we don't recognize their education. We so-called encourage international students to pursue studies in Canada, and then we charge them 3 times the tuition rate, which is a really racialized concept as well, right? Because you come from another country, you are forced to pay 3 times the rate. How many immigrant communities can afford to pay $15,000 a year as opposed to $5,000 a year for education, right? These type of systems systematically continue to bar immigrant communities from being able to access essential services. I want to talk about Canada's Anti-Terrorism Act. How many people here have actually read the legislation of Canada's Anti-Terrorism Act? I quote from the Anti-Terrorism Act that immigration and security issues and all matters relating to security and acts of terrorism come from far beyond our borders, so we must stop them before they get here, right? So basically, you can Google the legislation. That's the wording in the legislation. So basically, they're saying that terrorism is an imported problem, that terrorism is something that comes from foreign countries, right? And by framing the discussion of national security in the exact same sentence in which you talk about immigration, you basically paint a picture in which immigrants are a threat to our national security, even though statistically there has been and is no proof within Canada showing that bodies of color or immigrant communities are more likely or are likely at all to commit acts of terrorism, right? But that is the legislation we are spewing, and it is based on some sort of unproven idea of immigrants as threats. I also wanted to talk about, I talked about how immigrants are not allowed to access basic essential services. So I wanted to give two examples, and I want to sort of talk about how no one is illegal, particularly has mobilized around those issues. So the first one is police services. How many people here have heard of the don't ask, don't tell policy? Okay, so basically, people who used to go to the police were not who didn't have status were often detained or deported as opposed to being able to access a police service, right? So no one is illegal. We went into Heritage Inn, which is basically a detention center. So this is where non-status people are detained until Canada can decide whether or not to deport them or continue to allow them to stay. And within this detention center, we didn't go in as no one is illegal because they probably wouldn't have let us, but we sort of just went as volunteers, and we sort of saw the situations within Heritage Inn. It's basically set up like a prison. Men and women are separated. Kids who are below the age of 12 stay with their mother, and if they're over the age of 12, they have to stay in the youth department. They tell you when to eat. They tell you when to shower. You're not allowed out of the center. And three times a week during designated times, you're allowed to visit with your family, right? So this is how non-status immigrants are treated. The center is very much a prison. And what came out when we were talking to the women in Heritage Inn is that many of them were sent there because they were raped or abused by partners, husbands, people, in some cases ambiguous people on the street. And when they had gone to the police to report the crime, it was found out that they were non-status, and instead of persecuting the perpetrator of the crime, they were sent to Heritage Inn in detention, right? So thousands of women were too afraid to access this service. So no one is illegal mobilized around this issue. And we had constant demonstrations and rallies and front of the police services board, and we finally got a don't ask policy passed. So the don't ask, don't tell policy. What that is when you try to access an essential service, the police or healthcare services or education people running education, they don't have a right to ask you for your status. And the don't tell part of the policy is that if they do find out your status, you have the right to continue to access that essential service, and that they don't tell that you are non-status, and they do not report you to immigration enforcement. So the idea, and what No One Is Illegal strives to do, is to reclaim one space at a time and implement the don't ask, don't tell policy, you know, within shelters, within food banks, within schools, within the police services, within community centers, within workplaces eventually, so that everyone has the right to continue to survive, to continue to work, and to continue to access these type of services. The police services has adopted the don't ask part of our policy, so it is now legal policy, and police are barred from asking the status when somebody is the victim or a witness of a crime, but they have so far refused to implement the don't tell part of the policy, which makes little sense to me, because it basically means you're not supposed to ask the status of someone, but should you find out, it's okay for you to report it if you think it's somehow relevant to the crime, right? So again, it becomes very arbitrary. It's basically up to a particular police officer whether or not they want to tell. And we've done the same thing in the school, the TDSB school board. So the Toronto District School Board has adopted an official don't ask, don't tell policy, because under Canada's Education Act, every child has a right to education regardless of status. But what we saw, I talked about Dufferin Mall, I talked about people being ID'd and randomly carded in public spaces. immigration officers were going into schools and taking out kids from a learning environment. There was the Lizana Sosa case, a grade 9 and 10 brother and sister. An immigration officer went into their classroom during a school day, pulled them out. When the kids were like, can we at least wait till the school day finishes, the officer, and I quote, said, you're never going to see your friends again, get into the truck. And they were forced inside of a detention truck and sent into the detention center. And no one is illegal mobilized around this with the help of unions, with the help of teachers, community support, fellow students from the Lizana Sosa school. And because of all the mobilization, we packed the Toronto District School Board's board meetings, right? We did not leave. We did not leave them alone. We picketed outside every one of their meetings until they agreed to give us space within a meeting to talk about our demands. We picketed outside of every boardroom. We picketed outside of every school to mobilize them for this issue. And eventually, after packing their boardrooms, they agreed that Canada's Education Act says all students are supposed to be entitled to education and that it was a violation of law to send immigration officers into the classroom. And now the Toronto District School Board follows the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, at least in theory. As far as have forms been changed, have teachers been trained, have educational sit-ins took place, I think there's still a lot of work to be done there, but it is official policy, and that has been one of No One Is Illegal's greatest victories because it has concrete effects on students' lives on an everyday basis. I think I'm pretty much going to end there. The last thing I sort of just wanted to talk about is Indigenous solidarity. So it's not possible basically to have a talk about migrant rights without acknowledging that all of us are migrants because we live on stolen Indigenous land, because we were not the first here, because this is a colonized country, and that because people have taken over the land from Indigenous and Aboriginal communities. So, like I said, racism in Canada cannot be talked about without talking about Indigenous solidarity. And the way No One Is Illegal sort of functions is we don't advocate rights for immigrants or for refugees. We are immigrants and we are refugees. And for those of us who are not, for those of us who do have citizenship, for those of us who have been born here, for those of us who are not Indigenous to the land, we take our direction from immigrant and refugee and Indigenous communities, and we place our struggle within theirs, and we march in solidarity, and we organize and work in solidarity with those communities. There's currently 7 Indigenous communities that are under attack, and I think it's really controversial into the way that police have dealt with the status of Aboriginal communities, non-status Aboriginals versus status Aboriginals. There are activists within Indigenous communities who are attacked by the police all the time and detained, often put in jail. And there's the case of Sean Brandt, for example. Recently, he was an activist, and he was put into jail. And he made the claim that Algonquin law came first and that Mohawk law came first. And under those laws, what he did in terms of defending his land and treaty rights was not illegal, right? But our police, Canadian police, have arrested him saying that he had no right to do the sit-in that he did in protecting his land. So basically, where do you draw the line? Whose laws get counted? Whose laws are given precedence? Who gets to be prioritized within these spaces? And one of No One Is Illegal's most biggest campaigns right now is organizing around the 2010 Olympics. So most of you probably know the Olympics is coming up, the SPP, the G8, the Olympics, it's all taking place in 2010. And No One Is Illegal, with a lot of ally activist groups, are working to shut that down because the 2010 Olympics is taking place on Indigenous stolen land. Thousands of Indigenous people have been displaced so that Canadian corporations can build hotels for tourists when they come to the Olympics. Urban non-status immigrants have been put to labor to build all of the new restaurants and coffee shops and hotels and tourist sites that are going to be built for the Olympics. Non-status laborers who are underpaid, who are overworked, working 16 to 20 hours a day for under $4 an hour. On stolen Indigenous land, we're forcing out the urban poor. Gentrification is taking place, all for corporate wealth, right? So there are two sides to the Olympic Games, and we are definitely opposing, as marginalized people, the side of it that sort of has the power dynamics involved. I'll end my talk there. Thanks.
All right. right. So as I was saying, we'd just like to thank our panel for this really interesting discussion. And I hope you guys, we're going to move on to questions and sort of like, question answer period, but any thoughts from you guys as well. I don't know if we mentioned in the planning of this event, we sort of had a motive to try to start up a working group around issues of immigration, around issues of rights for, you know, not to use the word illegal, but for, immigrants in any sort of status, and just try to really make this issue not end tonight and really promote more critical thinking and sort of more action basically founded in Guelph. And, you know, there's a lot of the themes that were spoken today can very well be applied to the community of Guelph, even though, you know, sometimes it seems like we might not be the most immigrant sort of driven community. It's not just Toronto. It's not like that. Like, we can do a lot of good as well, and supporting groups that are sort of functioning everywhere as well. So we'd like to again thank the panel discussion, and if anybody wants to have any comments or start discussions, please proceed to the mic. We set it up just behind there. And also, as you guys can see, the booth set up over there have a lot of really good information and also chances to sort of financially support some of the groups that have spoken today and all for really good causes. So thank you very much.
Can I just mention something I wanted to mention, I forgot? For those of you who are interested in mobilizing around immigrant and refugee rights, Known as Illegal has recently started student networks at a lot of the major universities. So we have it at York University. We just started one at University of Toronto, both the St. George and Mississauga campus. We started it at Humber College and Sheridan College. If students at Guelph are interested in starting a student network of Known as Illegal on Guelph campus, please come speak to me after. We have mobilized around university cases as well. There was a student recently at U of T, Saad Alam, and a student at York University, Sarah Leonte, and they were both facing deportation. And Known as Illegal and its allies mobilized around those cases, did huge demonstrations, demanded that students have access to post-secondary education regardless of status, and we were able to halt their deportations. As for policy change, we're still working on that, but we are mobilizing around those issues. So if people are interested, please let me know after.
Hello. All right, perfect. I just had a thank you very much, first of all, for coming out. It was a beautiful event, and, well, not beautiful, but really inspirational, and to see the true system of immigration in Canada. I just had a question regarding the fact that Canada's seeking immigrants who can offer capital and are skilled. But I find that once I've talked to a lot of immigrants that come with PhDs, with masters from their country of origin, and come here, and their degrees and their qualifications are completely disregarded and ignored, and they come and work in those jobs that Canadians don't want to do. So I just wanted to ask if what are your thoughts on that, and why are they disregarded, and why does Canada want to bring over immigrants who are qualified, but that doesn't really even matter in the end anyway.
Yeah, okay. Did you want to hear from someone particularly?
No.
Or just, so my take on this, and I think they can both add if they want to, is that, as I mentioned, although I may not have finished my thought, I think Canadian immigration system looks for sort of there's a binary between the type of immigrants we look for. So there is the type that have capital who can invest, so like the business class of immigrants, and they're the type of people who can invest within our economy, and they are often allowed in. But like you said, while we talk about needing people who have degrees and who are more educated and professional, we continue to allow people who either have their degrees disregarded and they continue to work underpaid exploitable jobs, or they come here right from the beginning as people who don't have that education, who don't have that professional background, and those are the type of immigrants we're constantly let in. So I think what that speaks to is the labor shortages Canada has and who we expect will fill it, right? So the majority of taxi drivers are people of color from the global south. It's not a coincidence, right? The majority of people who work in the backs of hotels, the majority of people who are working as live-in caregivers for either the elderly or for children, the majority of people who are working in construction, it's not a coincidence that they're immigrants and that the majority of them are non-status immigrants, right? So I think that speaks to the type of labor we need, who we expect to fill it, which is a really racialized process. And I think that goes back to treating immigrants as second-class citizens because they're doing the jobs we don't want to do and we actively seek them out that way, right? So even though the majority of immigrants today don't qualify under the point system, why are there more than 500,000 allowed in? Are they all just so sneaky and sly that they got in and somehow it was under our noses? Or are we actively seeking people because we have these labor shortages we need filled, right? That's my take on it. Perfect. Does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah, sure. If anybody else wants to add something, it's fine. But thank you, though.
Well, I'm also baffled that Canada doesn't do more to have assistance programs to make sure that qualifications can be brought in line and these people can work in their areas. It's shocking because they are attracting these people based on their skills and then their skills can't be used. So I wish I could offer you an explanation. It just seems ridiculous to me.
Thank you.
Okay. I had a couple of questions and one is sort of related to that and one is more general. I don't know if you want me to come up to the mic again, but I'll just ask both of them now anyway. First of all, you talked a little bit about the role of unions in helping to mobilize for migrant workers and non-status immigrants.
Could you just speak up a little bit?
Okay. Yeah. You talked okay. A little bit about the role of unions in terms of mobilizing around non-status immigrants and migrant workers. And sort of related to her question, in terms of other professional associations and guilds who sort of function as the gatekeepers in terms of getting these people the qualifications they need to work.
For sure.
From the perspective of the activist community, what's being done to build those linkages? And the second question is more general, and it's more about sort of shifting from the immigration debates from sort of entitlement, who gets in, what they have the right to, and what we have, as opposed to what we have rights to. How do we shift that attitude towards one of sort of solidarity and sort of human rights dialogue? I mean, Bill C-50 there was some very spirited debate in that on that in Parliament, but I think we really missed an opportunity there to sort of bring those issues to the wider population. I'm just wondering for everybody what their thoughts are on shifting those attitudes. Thanks.